you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome. This is Elder Talk. This is Joe Cordell. With me, my co-host, Susan Arthur. Today, we're going to talk about the brain, and we're going to talk about what our nature is as people. I mean, many people think that there's the physical world and there's the spiritual world. But those of us who are believers think that, well, no, these things are really the same world and that there's a spiritual dimension to the physical world. And yet some experts, you know, suggest that no, all there are atoms and molecules around us. And so there's nothing but the physical stuff. So thankfully, we have someone who is an expert on this topic, and he's going to talk about the role of spiritual things and the brain. You want to tell us about our guest?
I would love to. Dr. Lynn Matheson is a neurorehabilitation psychologist and an inventor who has taught and conducted research for most of his career, most recently at Washington University School of Medicine and at Covenant Theological Seminary. He is a consultant to several Fortune 100 employers and insurance carriers, the Social Security Administration, the United States Congress, the American Medical Association, and hundreds of rehabilitation centers and governmental agencies in the United States, Canada, and other countries. Dr. Matheson has testified before the United States House of Representatives in Washington and has published 58 peer-reviewed scientific papers. He is the director of research at the Faithful Brain Institute, director of research at Epic Rehab, and the author of the book, Your Faithful Brain, Designed for So Much More. Plus, he maintains an active consulting and counseling practice working with people who have physical, neurological, and psychological disabilities. Thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to be with us today.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Joe.
Yes. Well, thank you for being here. And, you know, it's an unlikely path to go from teaching at Washington University School of Medicine to Covenant Theological Seminary.
It was a path that I was driven to. I left WashU, retired about 10 years ago now, and found myself with a little bit too much time on my hands and missing the classroom. So I approached Covenant and asked if they'd want me to help teach the counselor's program, master's in counseling degree they have there. And they said yes, and I was there for 8 years and retired just recently.
Well, and it's emblematic of the theme of this show, and I think to a great extent of your book, and that's that, you know, there is this very scientific, evidence-based argument that the brain is not simply the sum of its physical parts, that we as human beings are designed to be something more. And I think your career kind of reflects that, and perhaps you're ending up at the peak in terms of, you know, the source of what the brain is and what it's about. Can you kind of give our listeners an introduction to that subject?
Sure. The big picture is that our brains were created by God to fit into His created reality. So our brains were designed so that if we follow what the Bible teaches and what Jesus exemplifies, what Paul tells us about, and what we learn if we go to church and pay attention, we really work out best. Our brains are as healthy as they can be. We fit in as well as we can.
So what are the implications, though, of a different message that I think is more broadly disseminated today that says that, no, there isn't anything but this very physical brain, this set of molecules? I mean, I'm wondering, what are the implications of a message that is so far afield of what you contend, and I agree, is the truth?
To the degree that scientists are honest with themselves and look at the brain closely, eventually we get to realizing that it's more than just happened by happenstance. It's more than just an accidental event, an accidental occurrence. The brain is inherently complex, more complex than anything in the universe. And without some pattern of organization, growth, and ongoing care that's exemplified and demonstrated to us in the Bible, chaos erupts. We see that pretty easily as we take a look at, for instance, 100 billion neurons in each of our adult brains with 38,000 trillion operations per second, faster than all but the best supercomputers. 38,000 trillion operations per second, without organization, you get chaos. Mm-hmm. And so we are comfortable in our brains without fully appreciating them. And so when I talk with scientists, one of the things that I've done is to identify the possible combinations in the brain and label that with the word godzillion, because scientists, and I consider myself a scientist, like to count. We like to put numbers, quantify. So I think the actual answer is that the closer you look at the brain, the more you realize that there's something beyond just the biology of the brain.
Do you find this concession then among your more secular counterparts in their acknowledgement increasingly now that there's this distinction between the mind and the brain? Perhaps they're not prepared to call it spiritual. Perhaps they're not prepared to concede the supernatural. But they're willing to concede, it is more than the sum of the parts. There's this thing called the mind.
Yes.
Do you think that that's a step in the right direction?
I do, and it's part of the mystery that we have to accept. As Christians, we accept the mystery of, for instance, the triune God. And I think scientists, although they're uncomfortable with mysterious things, mysterious experiences, can get to a point where, for instance, Einstein got there eventually, said, you know, there's something more here that we can't understand. And, for instance, Christians back in the mid and early 20th century really got concerned about the Big Bang theory, demonstrating that it was all science, physics, and God actually doesn't exist. But Einstein himself went back and said, wait a minute, there's something more here than even I can understand. God doesn't play dice with the universe was a famous phrase of his.
Yeah.
And as I took a look at the brain, and here in St. Louis we have the Human Connectome Project, as I took a look at the brain, I found that inherently we would have chaos if we didn't have some purpose, some degree of organization, some rationale that was provided by something other than happenstance.
And you don't think, though, that random selection is sufficient to explain how we got here without a intelligent plan?
I think random selection was actually an invention of God, and I think guided by God, and to the degree, for instance, as Jesus came on the planet 2,100 years ago, to guide us further in our development, to the degree that we pay attention to his lessons, we do a better job using our brains, developing our brains. And it's really important in this day and age to do that. I think you'll find that the churches around the country that are thriving are churches where the pastors are teaching about how to appreciate, for instance, the science that's pertinent that can expand rather than constrict our faith. I think good science, for instance, in the neuroscience area, points to faith as a necessary part of living life the way we were designed to live.
And people who don't have faith, who are increasingly common today in this culture at least, I wonder to what extent where we see the problems associated with that around us. Do you see consequences that you think are there relating to this denial of a spiritual reality?
Absolutely, and I was a good example of that. I was raised in a Christian home, but in my early 20s, pushed God away, actually became an anti-theist, not just an atheist, but an anti-theist. God never let me go. He brought me back into the fold through a series of experiences that started February 3, 1970, when I first met a young man named Danny Monday. Danny was 14 years old at the time, had spinal muscular atrophy. He was a patient at Rancho Los Amigos Hospital, where I had my first professional job. February 3, 1970, I met Danny. He already knew he was dying, a 14-year-old dealing with a mortal illness. He died several months later. He taught me how important it was to have God in your life. And it was really difficult for me to continue to sustain my anti-theism in the face of Danny and other people like Danny. I put that in the book. And that was a real important part of my growth that continued for several years until I crossed the line of faith about 22 years ago now, really under the guidance of Rick Warren and my wife.
Because you attended Saddleback Church at one time before you came out here.
Yes, and Rick's a good example. My pastors all along have been really good teachers. Rick's a great example of a teacher who doesn't back away from science. He recognizes that science is also part of God's mystery, God's creation, and we can be comfortable with it. You know, your daughters, as an example, I think as they get more and more into science and they grow them, they grow their knowledge base, they're going to become more solid in their faith rather than start to be skeptical about their faith.
And it's a shame that this dualism ever came into the world. I mean, during the Enlightenment, if not sooner, there was this fork in the road between spiritual things and things of this world. And some things were assigned to one and others were assigned to the other. And it kind of opened the door, I think, for Darwin to say, well, I have the answers for, you know, humanity without having to resort to this supernatural option. Mm-hmm. But your argument is these are inextricable. I mean, they're all laws that God created. Would you say that, or would you say there are fundamental distinctions between the physical and the spiritual?
Well, first of all, I think Darwin helped us make some progress in biology, but we need to recognize that he was only talking about biology. He wasn't talking about the whole of human existence, all of science. And he only gave us a partial answer. We can take that within a context that the larger answer is found. The larger answer really, I think, scientists who develop their science, who really study the complexity of what they're looking at, eventually get to something that has boundaries on it, beyond which we have to say there's only mystery. And for me, what helps me feel comfortable with that mystery is my faith. I believe that God created us. God created the reality that we sit in. God created the opportunity for us to get together today. To the degree that the three of us communicate using honesty, integrity, transparency, really being willing to listen to each other, we'll do our best work for God today. Our listeners are going to benefit from that.
So then, first of all, it's interesting that you, rather than rejecting Darwin entirely, it sounds like you say, well, it is conceivable that he described a process. Perhaps he didn't attribute it to a divinely created process, but you would say Darwin described a process that could, in fact, roughly be describe the way by which human beings emerged.
He was describing something. His interpretation of it was too limited. And so we need to recognize that he had a limited interpretation of what he was describing. And now we can go on as we learn more and more and look more closely at each aspect of biology, at physics, at, you know, pick your science. We can get to a level of amazement and awe. And that amazement and awe goes beyond our ability to understand. And that, for me, is part of the experience of God. And so to the degree that a scientist is honest about the limitations of his or her knowledge, what is beyond those limitations is best described, best understood in terms of the faith that we can develop about how that all fits into this world that we're operating in.
But you believe, though, that there are some things we can know. Like, I think Aquinas gave the metaphor of a house with two stories, in which, you know, the one story is the God that we learn from the physical world, and the other story we can only access through information such as Scripture and divine revelation. You would generally agree with that?
Yes, I do.
So what do you think, though, of those who are believers today, but if you press them closely or observe their behavior, they appear more to be deists? And for the listeners who don't know what that is, that deism is the idea that, yes, God exists, and yes, he created the world, we'll concede that, but then he kind of stepped back, and he lets it unfurl according to its own processes, and he doesn't intervene. And that's attractive because it gets you over you know, lots of the complaints of your more scientific, quote unquote, peers or friends or whatnot. But I suspect that what you believe, and certainly what I believe, is that no, God did those things. In addition, he's involved on a regular basis. And do you believe that?
Deism gets you to first base. It's Jesus that gets you around to home plate again. And it's really important to recognize the distinction between the two. C.S. Lewis was a deist for about a year in his journey.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he became a Christ follower after, he says, 11, 12 months, something like that. I was a deist for longer than that. And one of the things that my wife and Rick Warren helped me do is to get beyond myself to the point where I said, I surrender. Jesus, thank you for being here. God, thank you for giving us Jesus so that I've got a person that I can look to and basically say that I'm a broken person. Thank you for rescuing me. Thank you for your grace. And I cannot believe the sacrifice that you're willing to make for me. Help me, for instance, learn how to sacrificially love my wife. You know, not to be just in a contract marriage with my wife, but be in a covenant marriage. I think Jesus has a covenant with each of us who are Christ followers that's way beyond what a contractual relationship is. And for instance, that's one of the things I say in the book about having a covenant marriage is really a crucial part of fitting into God's created reality.
Can we kind of shift a little bit and let's maybe kind of get in some of that practical way on some of these, how the faithful brain really affects us practically in terms of our brain development, mm-hmm. in terms of how we live our lives, that type of thing. Can we kind of shift the direction a little bit? Because I'm getting a little lost.
You're thinking that the audience doesn't find the more philosophical questions as interesting.
I think it's interesting, and I think we've laid a really good foundation for why we want to do this. But I'm thinking, you know, does just going to church, is that just going to help me live longer, live healthier, have a happier life, that type of thing?
Okay, so just so that we don't believe that, or our audience doesn't believe that this is entirely without practical value, where we've come so far is we've established that God continues to intervene in the world, and that he, you know, there is a God who answers prayers in some form and his willingness. Miracles exist. Do you agree with that, Doctor?
I'm nodding my head, and I'll say yes, so the people who can't see me nodding my head okay. know that I'm agreeing with you.
All right, so now what you want to hear, Susan, is let's talk about the brass tacks here. What are the practical implications of your thesis?
So since this is elder talk, let's talk about issues that elders are really concerned about. Let's start with dementia. In Susan's brain, she's got about 110 billion neurons. Since I'm a couple of decades older than she is, I've maybe got 95 billion neurons. If I take care of my 95 billion neurons by, for instance, studying and learning new, taking on new challenges and learning new tasks, developing my abilities, I develop what's called cognitive reserve capacity. And that cognitive reserve capacity is kind of like extra gas in the tank, so that when my, for instance, if I begin to develop Alzheimer's disease, the dementia doesn't show up as quickly. And it's important to recognize, I hope your listeners realize, that the disease is not the same as the dementia. There's Alzheimer's disease and there's Alzheimer's dementia. And for instance, just a real simple distinction between the two is that many people have Alzheimer's disease before it shows up as a problem with thinking or memory.
Maybe for decades?
Decades, even? Often. And the longer, the people who have more cognitive reserve capacity, for example, people who have been students in adulthood, gone back to college or studying something very serious like learning a new language or picking up a musical instrument and developing skills with it, those people have more cognitive reserve capacity. And so they tend to have a longer trajectory before the dementia actually shows up.
So they might go perhaps 5 to 10 years or more longer before they have the debilitating symptoms.
Most of the scientists that look at this say it's about a 10-year benefit that you get from continuing to study in adulthood.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, and it makes you recognize that somebody like Ronald Reagan who developed the visible stages of Alzheimer's was actually pretty old at that time. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that that was deferred for probably decades because of the many challenges he faced in his role as president. On one hand, he had the stress, so I don't know which outweighed the other. Mm-hmm. The stress couldn't have been helpful, but he certainly had the challenges to his brain on a daily basis.
And that's a real good example. We want to have what I call just right challenges. President Reagan did, but he also had the ability to maintain stress at a reasonable level. Nancy protected him a lot. He had really good people around him, his Secretary of State, all the fellows and women, too, who worked for him. This is something I was very aware of because I was out in California at the time when he was governor, and I saw up close, and I had some friends who actually did some work with him, that he was able to manage the stress at a level that is really important to pay attention to. So those of us who are taking on challenges, as long as we're managing the stress at a reasonable level, our brains seem to do best. And so that's one of the things that helps us.
Point.
And one of the things that helps us manage stress is an actual relationship with a loving God. So for instance, one of the things I like to really focus on when I'm working with my clients is what I call brain restorative sleep. Brain restorative sleep is my keystone habit in my life. I'm drinking some peppermint tea here because I want to minimize caffeine, which can disrupt my homeostasis, which might give me some difficulty with sleep when I put my head in the pillow tonight at 10 or 10:30.
I'm in trouble.
Well, it's really important to pay attention to that. I really work with my clients and we find that people who have brain restorative sleep can take tremendous stress and be much more resilient.
I think that's something we take for granted. I think we forget how much our body regenerates during that sleep time. I keep telling my kids that when I'm trying to get them to go to bed. But, you know, really, you need it especially when you're not feeling well or when you have extra stresses in your life, like tests and things like that, or whether medical tests or whatever. Your body regenerates during sleep. I mean, you need that good sleep pattern.
And one of the ways I help people get that good sleep is with bedtime prayers. I really take seriously in my own life and then in my clients' lives, whether they're Christians or not, it's much easier with people who are actually Christ followers, that getting right with God as you start to drop off to sleep puts you in a frame of mind. Your brain isn't going to sleep. Your brain is still active. Parts of your brain have quieted down, but some parts are still very active. To the degree that you trust that God's got you while you're sleeping, you're in a much deeper sleep earlier, and the brain's housekeeping is much much better than it would be if you were going to sleep worrying about how you're going to pay the bill the next day or, you know, different things that people normally think about as they're dropping off to sleep.
What about getting up in the morning? So people start the day, they wake up, they may think of these pressing issues the moment their eyes open or soon thereafter. What is your prescription for the start of the day?
First of all, don't use an alarm clock to wake up. Use it as a backup. Try to wake up naturally at the end of your last sleep cycle, and you can learn to do that.
That Krebs cycle, or whatever it's called?
Well, yeah, it's the REM cycle that as we go through over the course of the night, our sleep cycles are about 90 minutes long. And at the end of the sleep cycle, you have about a 60-second period where you're awake enough to change your covers, get up and urinate, whatever you need to do to keep yourself sleeping, go back to bed, fall back asleep pretty quickly. After four or five sleep cycles, your brain is much more likely to be ready to get up. I try to get five sleep cycles every night. And for my clients who've had, for instance, a stroke or a concussion, I try to get them six sleep cycles every night. And then if you wake up in the morning, naturally, before you get out of bed, thank God for the day ahead. Thank God for your family. Thank God for the opportunities that are going to be facing you. For me, I pray for help with my clients for that day. I'm going to be, you know, as a psychologist working with people who are really struggling. And I don't have all the answers, so I ask God to help me get ready to have the answers and then during the day pray for guidance.
So gratitude is an important you would argue, essential component to mental health.
Absolutely. And there's lots of research that actually supports that.
So this is something that really is a product as much of that spiritual dimension of our minds, our brains, as the physical.
It actually is more important than the physical because it helps to take care of the physical. Our biology is going to proceed whatever we do. How does our biology proceed optimally? And that's within the context of a spiritual relationship with a loving God. I'll make a point that research having to do with, for instance, participation at church demonstrates about 85% of the studies demonstrate that people who have an active relationship with God do better than people who don't. The other 15% of the studies have identified people who don't have a loving God in their life. They've got more of a punitive God. They've got a God they're afraid of. And I think it's really necessary to get into a loving relationship with God so that we can fit into the intention that he has for us. That's why he sent Jesus to us. He loved us so much. He sacrificed his son. And that level of love and the grace that comes along with that is something that we can be grateful for, and that gratitude puts us in a frame of mind that's optimal for brain health and development.
So you said 85% do better. They do better in terms of just life in general, depression issues. How do they do better?
So it's 85% of the studies that have been done that have looked at the relationship between faith and health.
Recovery from illness is
one. Dealing with pain is another.
Okay.
Actually, longevity, the length of time that you live, people who are actively involved in church live much longer than people who don't.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's amazing, those studies. I read a recent reference to a similar point that's being made, a study, and I think it's in Wall Street Journal. It's just been the last few weeks, and I don't remember the specifics, but that's a consistent theme, and it's a theme that you can be sure you wouldn't be hearing about in secular media if there wasn't something to it, because clearly the bias is in the opposite direction. So whenever something makes its way to a news story in a place like that, you can believe that there must have been pretty substantial evidence for it.
And one of the things I'll point out, Yale University, a secular school, actually has a very powerful research program that has taken a look at the faith and health relationship. Harold Koenig, K-O-E-N-I-G, your listeners can Google him.
Koenig.
Has done the organizational work to identify. In the last book he did, 2,800 studies that looked at faith and health, and 85% of the studies demonstrated this positive relationship between them. So it's even in the secular universities. Just getting started.
Well, and I think I think all of us need to be in relationship. And whether that is relationship with God, relationship with others, if you're actively involved in a church, you're going to have relationship. You're going to have relationship with little kids. You're going to have people with older kids. I mean, the Bible gives us lots of examples on being in relationship, older teaching younger, that type of thing. And I just think that that's a part of it that we sometimes like to forget. You know, designed for relationship.
Let me point out one thing that your listeners can take with them. Relationship is facilitated, the bonding between people facilitated by a chemical called oxytocin.
Not Oxycontin.
No, oxytocin, O-X-Y-T-O-C-I-N. When moms give birth, their bodies are flooded with oxytocin that causes them to be bonded to their infant immediately. It triggers oxytocin rushes in the brain of the infant, and the husband who's available has that. One of my sisters is a NICU nurse, and she talks about the nurses are aware of the oxytocin in their own bodies as they come in and begin to bond with these sometimes very sick preemies. Oxytocin is available in every relationship that we have. Right now, we've got some oxytocin flowing amongst us because we're enjoying each other. You and your dog Scout have a relationship that helps you sleep at night because the oxytocin counteracts cortisol, which is a stress hormone. that can get in the way of good sleep at night. Oxytocin in the relationship between a husband and wife is optimal during intercourse. Loving intercourse produces oxytocin. But even holding hands walking down the street at night before you go to bed produces oxytocin. So one of the prescriptions I give my people who are, for instance, dealing with anxiety or problems with depression is to get more serious about the relationship first with God and then with other people who are trustworthy so they can harness this biology, which God built in and most people don't really know about, harness this biology to really take care of their brains.
And it's such a complicated subject that you people fundamentally disagree about, you know, the importance of spiritual factors in health. And yet, you know, as we indicated, there are studies that make this clear, but it's still, I suspect, a minority position in secular educational in academia. And I just think that until we acknowledge that we will suffer various illnesses as a society that we have. I mean, such as these, you know, I wonder what is it about human beings that they would choose on the scale that they have to commit suicide by taking people with them. To me, that seems like some sort of pathology. And not just on the part of that person, but some sort of social pathology. I mean, it'd be different if it were a one-off. But you know, people have always had access to guns. They've always had the ability to take out people with them. What is it about our modern world that has this occurring at the pace that it does when you would think that'd be such an aberration for human beings? And I would argue it would be a rebuttal to, you know, to the materialist notion of evolution, the materialist side of evolution, that's all we are is what would there be, what function would that serve in terms of evolutionary goals to have species that have this capacity in these numbers to go out and commit these atrocities? And I suspect that including self-destruction, maybe especially self-destruction. But there was a time when people, if you wanted a person to behave well, get them on their deathbed. The law once imputed a presumption that it was an exception to the hearsay rule. The hearsay rule says that you can't trust what somebody says someone else said, so we have to have them in court, which kind of makes sense. There's an exception to that for dying declarations.
Right.
And here was the notion, and it was much quoted by Lord Coke and other influential jurists throughout centuries from England and here, that a person will not die with a lie on his lips because of the spiritual consequences. That was simply accepted. It was like an oath in which you swore to God. You know, because there was this consensus, this collective agreement that we're accountable. But once you wipe that out, then you have people behaving with a sort of abandon that the only consequences could, if they would happen at all, would happen in this world, in the here and now. And it changes behavior. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and actually I work with combat veterans. And combat veterans often suffer what are called moral injuries. Part of the psychological consequence of war, where people go to war with a justification to care for their family, care for their country, do the right thing, wind up doing things that cause these moral injuries. They come back and they deal with the moral injuries. To the degree that we can help them get back into and recognize that they are in a right relationship with a forgiving, loving God, then they're able to go on and put their lives back together. I think that's an important piece of what is too often missing from combat rehabilitation. I'm working with a group down at Fort Campbell, Kentucky called Reboot Combat Recovery, and it's a faith-based group that helps people transition from combat back into civilian life. And they're very, very successful dealing with these moral injuries. It starts with, it's within the context of faith, though. I think that's a real good example of something that should be available throughout all of the VA, and it's not. Throughout all of the Department of Defense, and it's not. I think it's a real mistake when you take a look at historical battles. A lot of the battles were, we take a look at the Crusades, and people talk about Crusades as being something that was not fully righteous.
Yeah, but if you take ignoble, some would say.
Well, but if you take a look at the people who fought the Crusades, an important part of their resilience was their faith.
So whatever you might think of motives at the top, your point is, as to that person who was on the field putting their life on the line, they were driven by spiritual motives.
Right, and that gets watered down in our current Department of Defense work. There's a soldier resilience development program that was developed several years ago, and it's good as far as it goes, but one of the limitations is that they didn't get completely comfortable with spirituality. They watered it down too much. So the reason I'm really excited about what's being done with Reboot Combat Recovery down at Fort Campbell is that they're very open about it being a Christian approach.
So does this not, though, create those church-state problems that are so often an obstacle to this sort of therapy?
Absolutely. And for instance, the Reboot folks use the Family Services Center at the base with the permission of the commander, because the commander recognizes that the guys and gals that are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq and now Syria need and can benefit from that sort of service. They don't take any money. These Reboot folks are nonprofit, 501c3, but their support, they're given tacit approval, I guess we'd say, by the commander down there.
So I guess one difference in which this discussion could be kind of schizophrenic is that on the one hand, I find interesting what are the macro implications of this discussion, and what does it portend for us as a society? And of course, Susan keeps pulling us back. but what are the micro? Let's talk about applications for the individual listening. So. So I guess then hopefully we have some of each in this discussion. Bringing these two currents together would be to point out that to the extent, though, that we try to address problems that we have, whether it's stress, whether it's physical, whatever those problems may be that we're experiencing, if we deny this powerful factor, this essential ingredient to the recipe, then it simply is not going to allow us to have the sort of recovery or healing that would otherwise be available. And all too often, this is denied. And so one thing that I would want our listeners to appreciate from this and to realize that some additional explanation, of course, can be found in your book, which let me look at it here, Your Faithful Brain, is that you encourage that they harness this critical component when they think about being healthy and having a healthy brain and living a long time generally. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think if we can use an analogy from the automotive world, we are like Ferraris. We're fantastically designed, beautiful instruments. Our brains are incredible. And if we give ourselves unleaded gasoline, we're going to be able to get to the grocery store and back, but we're not going to really race. And I think what happens is that people don't develop an active relationship with Christ. They'll go to church or not go to church, and maybe go to church Christmas and Easter, and that's it, and assume that, that's all there is. There's a lot that they're missing. And it's not just getting a fire insurance policy. It really is, hey, we were designed this way. Let's take advantage of the design.
It relates to our performance.
Absolutely.
And that's an important distinction worth repeating, is many people think of religion as, use the phrase fire insurance, but as this thing that covers us, for the next world. And so, we want to be sure and acknowledge that. And even believers who have great intentions are thinking that this main application is the next world. But your point is, no. Yes, the next world, but it's essential for this world. Because it's a component of the design.
Absolutely. We really make the most use of what God designed into our brains by paying attention to the lessons in the Bible. Where do we get that information? Well, probably at church by people who've been trained to teach us how to use the Bible appropriately.
Incidentally, I would have put unleaded gas in a Ferrari. What is a Ferrari supposed to run?
At least you weren't putting leaded gas in it. No, I just think what a great way. You know, all of us want to live longer, more healthy. We want to do all of these things, and we want to pop a pill. We want to do these easy solutions. I'm thinking, how easy is it to go to church? I mean, you know, it's a simple thing that's going to help us live longer, probably live healthier, live happier, all of these things. And it's just getting up and going to church. I mean, isn't that better than a pill?
Yeah. And I guess that it simply points to the design, and that there's this kind of multifactorial thing that comes together to make things work. And and like going to church. Well, let's take a step back and talk about prescriptions of the Bible, among which are, you know, a lifestyle that is communal with other believers, you know, worshiping together, whether it's church or whatever context it is, worshiping together and sharing and praying and caring and doing good for others. I mean, all these things have this very real benefit to us because of our design that many of us don't even acknowledge.
And I would like pastors, my pastor, Greg Holder, here in town over at The Crossing, uses this knowledge from the pulpit to help young people who are going through at 18, 19 years of age some struggles with trying to decide how they fit into a faithful life and how faith fits into their life, to help them justify what they're going to be able to do as adults. First of all, how to handle college and the challenges that come up there. But then as they get into marital relationships, what that's going to look like. And I think this knowledge gives young people more of a justification beyond just accepting what some adult has told them. It gives them more justification for actually adhering to a life of faith.
So then people who lived out the Christian message, that live the lifestyle that Christ prescribes, it would, all things being equal, would have a much happier, fuller, healthier, longer life than someone else, all things being equal.
That's a great summary of what I believe.
So, but how difficult that is to live in a world where the forces all around you are pulling you in an opposite direction. For example, materialism. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think America has to hold some history, some record in terms of the history of humanity, in terms of our focus on stuff. And it's incredible. I was reading about consumer debt in America and the rate at which it's grown, even though some would point out, oh, but it's a little less than it was, you know, in 08, which is technically true. The bottom line is that the drift since the 70s, and, well, you can go back to the 50s in terms of the percent of GDP that was consumer debt was half of what it became in the 70s, and then half again of what it became in the 21st century. And so you have this force. You have forces relating to hedonism, you know, that look, we have the ability to enjoy life, we should enjoy life, and whatever that consists of, each person does his own thing. We have the fact that God is not discouraged, he's banned from the marketplace in many respects, from governmental activities, functions in large ways. So my point is, we live, people who are trying to walk this walk that you're describing, that you say, yes, it's healthy and this is what we should be doing, but they're in an environment where everything is saying no, 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 and obstacles exist all around them to accomplishing that.
It takes a lot of courage to live a life of faith in this context, but it's certainly doable. There are, you know, the three of us are doing it, and a lot of people we know are doing it.
And I would use another word. I would use determination. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's a good way to say it.
It takes a resolve, a resolve that has to be reaffirmed continually because of these contrary forces.
Well, and I think something to remember about that is that it's not just a put my nose, I'm going to plow through this type of thing. There's a benefit to doing that. There's a benefit to your brain, to your outlook. I mean, that's what we've been talking about, is if we're going to live a life of faith, there are benefits to it. I mean, and I don't think God is just saying, oh, just plow through life. He wants us to live a full life. And I think that that's one of the things that we can be accomplished. And the science is proving it out, but it's the science that we don't hear about.
That is encouraging, the way you said that, actually. It one could get the impression that you lower your head and you just trudge forward. But, and there may be some of that, incidentally. But your point is, if we do this stuff, we should see tangible results. Mm-hmm. So there is a strong incentive. I mean, your message here is, here's somebody who has taught at Washington University School of Medicine, one of the top two or three schools in the world. This is one of the elite educational scientific institutions in the world. And you, and the result of your experience has been what you've said here today. It's just an eloquent message that people should pause and listen to. Now, incidentally, were you able to deliver messages like this to a classroom at Washington University School of Medicine?
On a limited basis. We had some really interesting experiences, but it was limited, yeah.
I would think so. I would think it could jeopardize tenure. I would think that wouldn't be the fastest track to tenure.
Well, if you have people who are scientists who are very serious about their science, then we can have good discussions. People who are tentative and feel inadequate in their science tend to get their backs up and not listen. But I've had some good discussions with true scientists who disagree with me, but at least we can talk about it. And I use that as an opportunity to share use myself as an example as best I can. Danny Monday, the young man I mentioned that met the first day of my career, he was an example to me. Jesus is an example. So not just Danny preaching to me, the way Danny handled his upcoming death, lived life every single day as a gift from God. And boy, it was hard for me as an anti-theist back then to ignore that.
Boy, time has gotten past us. I really enjoy your comments and your perspective and your knowledge. And it's good Susan and I did this show together, because we probably would have ended up going down the philosophical road further than we did. And Susan kept us grounded here. So a marvelous information. Again, Your Faithful Brain is the name of the book, Designed for So Much More. This has been Dr. Leonard Matheson, PhD. And if you want to learn more about this topic, you can certainly buy the book. And in addition, do you maintain a blog or a website?
At faithfulbrain.com.
Okay, faithfulbrain.com for more info. It's been a pleasure, Doctor. Another episode of Elder Talk. See you next week.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.